from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, the Battle for New York.
On September 20th, 2001, President Bush stood before a joint session of Congress, a still grieving and shocked nation, and a confused world. And he changed the direction of our ship of state. He dedicated America, under his leadership, to destroying global terrorism.
Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani headlines the opening night of the Republican National Convention, telling delegates Bush's re-election will honor the victims of September 11th. We'll speak with columnist Jack Newfield about Giuliani and his career. Then, as the Republican convention moves towards George W.'s acceptance speech on Thursday, today activists in New York have declared a day of direct action and civil disobedience. More than 600 people have been arrested in the streets of New York over the past few days. We'll look at the conditions the protesters face behind bars, and we'll be joined by hip-hop artist Michael Franti, who was in the streets yesterday, having recently returned from Iraq and Palestine.
It was great to be out there, just to be a drop in this mighty river that's changing the world right now.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, the Battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman. The Republican National Convention opened last night in New York at Madison Square Garden, just 3 miles from Ground Zero. Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and Senator John McCain called for President Bush's reelection and praised his handling of the September 11th attacks and the war on terror. Speakers repeatedly invoke the memory of September 11th, which killed some 3,000 Americans in the attacks, and defended President Bush's term in office and his decision to invade and occupy Iraq. Outside Madison Square Garden, protests are continuing today for a fifth day in a row. The A31 coalition has called for a day of direct action against the Republican convention. Meanwhile, the War Resisters League, Voices in the Wilderness, and other activist groups are planning to stage a die-in in front of Madison Square Garden. On Monday, more than 15,000 marched in a protest organized by the Still We Rise Coalition. Thousands also rallied in the Poor People's March for Economic Human Rights. Police arrested about 20 protesters in demonstrations yesterday, bringing the total to over 600 in the past 5 days. The National Lawyers Guild yesterday accused the city of preventing jail protesters from seeing lawyers, and they charged the arrested protesters were being held in poor conditions. We'll get reports from the streets, from both people on the streets as well as the lawyers concerned about the conditions where those arrested are being held. Earlier in the day, the Republicans approved a new party platform with little debate. The New York Times reports for the first time the platform puts the party firmly on the record against legalized abortion, gay marriage, and other forms of legal recognition for same-sex couples. The gay rights group Human Rights Campaign called the platform one of the, quote, most discriminatory platforms in modern history. And economic issues. The platform calls for the privatization of Social Security and for making President Bush's tax cuts permanent. Democrats have accused the Republicans of trying to mask the conservative nature of the party platform by showcasing speakers who appeal to moderate voters, such as Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's headlining tonight. Meanwhile, 17 former Republican office holders, including ex-senators and governors, have joined together to call on the GOP to, quote, come back to the mainstream. The group has taken out a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for the party to take more moderate stances on the environment, foreign policy, and judicial appointments. While speakers at the convention repeatedly praised how President Bush has waged the so-called war on terror, the president has for the first time cited doubts if the war on terror is winnable. Matt Lauer of NBC asked him recently, quote, can we win? To which Bush replied, quote, I don't think you can win, but I think you can create conditions so that those who use terror as a tool are less acceptable in parts of the world, Bush said. And the Washington Post reports the FBI has interviewed senior Pentagon officials, including Douglas Feith, in connection with an investigation into a Pentagon analyst who's suspected of spying for Israel. The analyst, Larry Franklin, is suspected of sharing classified documents on U.S. policy towards Iran with AIPAC, that's the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which then turned the documents over to Israel. Franklin worked in the Pentagon's Near East and South Asia Bureau, which was headed by Feith, who also oversaw the controversial Office of Special Plans. They were both part of the neoconservative wing of the Pentagon that advocated for the invasion of Iraq and has pushed for a hardline stance toward Iran. The Washington Post also reports law enforcement agents are close to filing charges and that Larry Franklin may soon be arrested. In news from Iraq, the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has ordered his militia to suspend attacks across Iraq. Sadr's armed movement has led much of the Shiite resistance against the U.S. occupation. In addition, Sadr called for the U.S. to pull its troops out of all the city centers in Iraq. Aides to Sadr said the cleric would soon announce his entrance into politics. In other news from Iraq, an Iraqi resistance group has claimed that it has executed 12 Nepalese hostages. Pictures of their throats being slit have appeared on the internet. In Afghanistan, U.S. warplanes have reportedly bombed a village in eastern Afghanistan, killing at least 6 people and destroying 8 houses. The attack came after rockets were fired on a nearby security post. Meanwhile, the death toll in Sunday's bombing of the Dyne Corps headquarters in Kabul has increased to 12. Dyne Corps provides a private militia to protect the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, and trains the Afghan police force. It was the first major attack in Kabul in more than a year.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan. And he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy. He's fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the wall.
Buffy St. Marie, Universal Soldier, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, The Battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast on more than 240 radio and television stations around the country in the largest public media collaboration in the United States, broadcasting on Pacifica radio stations. And a very special welcome to our KGNU Denver audience, KGNU buying a radio station in Denver, reaching more than 2.5 million more listeners. Welcome to the Pacifica Public Radio, Public Access TV, and Dish Network Free Speech TV family, broadcasting also on both satellite networks, Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, and Link TV, Channel 375 of DirecTV. Well, today in New York, several groups are planning a day of direct action and civil disobedience. Some of the actions have been planned, and others are being planned in secret. Already, some 600 people have been arrested. Yesterday, there were 2 major marches organized by the poor and disenfranchised. And unlike the massive half-million-person march on Sunday organized for United for Peace and Justice, these poor people's marches were not given permits. Early in the day, some of the 3,000 people gathered for the Still We Rise march that went from Union Square to Madison Square Garden. Later, the Kensington Welfare Rights Union organized the Poor People's March for Our Lives that kicked off at the UN. Rick Rowley of Big Noise Tactical Media was on the march and files this report.
Are we gathering in front of the United Nations because we not playing with Bush or Kerry. We want them to stop building the prisons, which is the second most money-making institution in the whole United States of America. And we want them to give our people housing and health care.
Across the street from the United Nations, under the trees of the plaza, thousands met to voice their opposition to war at home and abroad, and to challenge the city's hard line on protest by marching on Madison Square Garden without applying for a permit.
We're going to march, and we're going to let Bush, and we're going to let Kerry, and Cheney, and anybody else know that we're not playing with them, that they shouldn't be elected, that they're not willing to get in there and do the right thing. They spent $80 million just for security for about 7 days. You know how many people we can feed with $80 million? You know how many people we can save their lives with $80 million?
Protesters marched, chanted, and sang down Manhattan's Second Avenue. The atmosphere was festive and the mood was peaceful, that is, until the police moved in. Several officers came into the crowd and targeted one protester, but oddly, they used no handcuffs as they escorted him past the police line. That incident sparked what became a chaotic situation. As protesters began chanting, "Let him go," and videographers moved forward to document the arrest, the police attacked the crowd and made additional arrests. As night fell, the march reached a protest pen set up by police outside of the heavily barricaded Madison Square Garden. But as protesters entered the pen, police attempted to split the march in two, first with a metal barricade and then by charging the crowd with mopeds and beating protesters back with batons. The National Lawyers Guild reported only 20 arrests on Monday. In all, more than 600 people have been arrested protesting the RNC. The divide and arrest tactics used by police at yesterday's march have been seen over the past several days here in New York, as have the use of undercover officers, mopeds, and motorcycles. With today slated as the day of direct action and civil disobedience against the Republican National Convention, the number of arrests is bound to swell.
Rick Rowley of Big Noise Tactical Media reporting from the Poor People's March for Our Lives here for Democracy Now! Police arrested some 20 protesters yesterday, bringing the total to about 600 in the last 5 days. In response, the National Lawyers Guild held an emergency news conference on Monday to condemn the city for jailing nonviolent protesters and then denying them legal aid, food, and medical treatment. One of the speakers at the press conference was New York City Council member and mayoral hopeful Charles Barron.
This is the Patriot Act in action. And this is why people demonstrated. This is why more than half a million people came out to deny people legal access. These crimes or these offenses that were committed, so they say, should have been desk appearances and they should have been released. I know murderers who get access to lawyers. I know people who commit serious crimes who have access to lawyers. To deny us access is the Patriot Act in action. And this is why people demonstrated. We're calling on the mayor and the commissioner to intervene. This is ridiculous. This was a peaceful march. Over 500,000 people peacefully marched. And those we think were excessive arrest, excessive detaining, and denying them their legal rights is absurd. And we want the mayor to intervene right now, the commissioner, to get those who need any medical attention, they need to get that medical attention. And those who have been in there overnight, they need to be released immediately.
New York City Councilmember Charles Barron hopes to be mayor of New York, has already announced his candidacy. This is Democracy Now! As we talk about the protests and the conditions of jailed protesters that they face, we're joined by Norman Siegel, former head of the New York chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as Michael Franti, hip-hop artist, who's just returned from Iraq and the occupied territories Gaza and the West Bank. We'll talk later with him about that, but now about the protests that he participated in yesterday. But first, Norman Siegel, what is happening to these more than 600 people, about that number, who've been arrested?
They're being processed over on 15th Street on the West Side Highway, and there's lots of questions emerging. To begin with, lack of access to lawyers, lack of access to food, and delayed access to medical care. In addition, I was informed just recently by an official of the Transit Workers Union who used to lease that space, that that building had had and possibly continues to have a significant asbestos problem.
You're talking about Pier 57?
Correct. So I wrote the mayor and the police commissioner yesterday telling them that I've gotten this information and I'd like to know whether, A, they were aware of the history of this building, and if so, what did they do to investigate the asbestos problem? And if they didn't do anything about it, they should do it immediately. I haven't heard anything yet, and I am going to have a press conference today. We should not create any kind of a public health problem for people who are protesting and are detained on the West Side Highway.
Well, these protesters are being held at Pier 57 right off the West Side Highway on the west side of Manhattan. But who was there before? I mean, who are the people who inhabit the building otherwise?
Well, a while ago, the transit department was there, the MTA, I believe. And for a while, it was not occupied. I think that the city overreacted. They bought into the district attorney's argument that there would be 1,000 arrests a day. We've had 5 days, a little more than 100 a day average. That kind of average could have been processed through the regular system. The World Economic Forum 2 years ago, the same thing. They projected 1,000 arrests a day. There were merely 300 over the five-day period. So what they do is they set up a temporary detention facility. And I don't think it's A, needed, but B, if you're going to have a temporary detention facility, you have to make sure that there's no asbestos problem. And I call upon the mayor and the police commissioner to allow some of us to go in and investigate the conditions in that building immediately.
Norman Siegel of the New York chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, former head. Michael Franti, you were in the protests yesterday. Why'd you come to New York to do this, and what was the statement that you felt it was important to make here?
Well, I wanted to just be a part of this river, like I was saying, just to drop and to look into the eyes of hundreds of thousands of other people who feel the way that I do, that the Bush administration is leading us down a path that is not only dividing this nation, but it's dividing the planet. And to be out in the streets was very spirited. I saw so many different types of people, from young to old, every ethnic group imaginable. I saw people who were there because they felt very strongly about things that were happening specifically in the city, as well as people who were, you know, talking about worldwide foreign policy.
You marched in the Kensington Welfare Rights Union march?
I marched in both of them, yeah.
And did you see people get arrested?
I saw a couple people get arrested on the street. I didn't see mass arrests, but just, you know, kind of off to the side, there'd occasionally be somebody who seemed like maybe that they were just, you know, had said something to a police officer or were not doing direct action. And suddenly 5-10 cops would descend on that one person. Crowds would come around and start to, you know, observe and first shoot cameras. And then as the group built, there would be people that would be screaming against the police to let people go. Of course, they didn't.
Yesterday, we reported on the critical mass bike ride of Friday night. 5,000 cyclists went through New York. I can't say raced because there were so many of them. They slowly made their way through New York. Saw them at Times Square, and then our producer, Elizabeth Press, was detained with many others right at 34th Street, right next to Macy's, where the big Daily Show advertisement is that says, welcome to New York, that smell, freedom, as she was handcuffed with her hands behind her back, caught in a dragnet. They weren't giving any warning, the cyclists, and they were all caught up. The protest, the police calling them our guests. Let's move the guests onto the buses, they say.
The bikes should be returned. The police argue that they need the bikes for evidence. The police should take a Polaroid picture of the bikes and give the bikes back to the people. Otherwise, the bikes will be there for months.
What about the fact that they've been held for more than 24 hours in detention? When I asked a community police officer at that moment, he said, oh, they'll be brought over to Pier 57, and if they identify themselves, they'll be given desk appearance tickets. But it took days.
That shouldn't be. A desk appearance ticket takes anywhere from 4 to 6 hours. Reports say that people are being held for as long as 24 hours to get a desk appearance ticket. That's extraordinary, and it raises the question of whether or not they're doing this, as they did in the World Economic Forum, A, to make sure that people don't get back on the streets to protest, or B, to deter people from being involved in any kind of activity.
Norman Siegel, where's your news conference today in New York?
It's in front of Pier 57 at 10:30. And again, I'm very concerned about the asbestos problem. In addition to all the other situations, the city of New York should not put people in a building if there is a question about contamination of asbestos.
Norman Siegel, former head of the New York chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and Michael Fronte, I'd like to talk to you later about your trip back from Palestine and Iraq. But right now, if you can, well, sing us into our break. Michael Fronte.
Keep on walking now. Yes, I will. Don't keep on talking loud. Yes, I will. Gonna keep on singing about it. Yes, I will. We gonna keep on ringing out. Lost and alone. It's when a rainbow comes. When you're lost and alone, yeah. It's when a rainbow comes for you. Keep on walking. Keep on talking loud. I'm gonna keep on singing about it in the streets of New York City now. Yoo-hoo-hoo.
Michael Fronte, live in our Firehouse studio, here just blocks from Ground Zero. This is Democracy Now!, Breaking with Convention. Michael Boo back with us later in the program. Well, as the protests in the streets continue, the Republican National Convention kicked off last night at Madison Square Garden. But if you were watching on television, you might have thought you tuned into the country's most famous comedy show.
Republican National Convention with Mayor Mike Bloomberg. Senator John McCain. Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Senator Zell Miller. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mrs. Lynn Cheney. President Dick Cheney. And very special guest, President George W. Bush. Ladies and gentlemen, Chair Chairman Ed Gillespie.
No, that was not Saturday Night Live. It was the kickoff of the Republican National Convention, the theme of the opening night, that Americans owe it to the victims of September 11th attacks to elect George W. Bush to another four-year term to continue his so-called war on terror. Speakers at the podium defended Bush's invasion and occupation of Iraq and portrayed his rival John Kerry as soft on terror. An Iraqi woman, Zineb al-Swag, addressed the convention wearing hijab on her head and defending the invasion of Iraq. A woman whose husband was killed on September 11th praised Bush for his leadership following the attacks, as did former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik, who headed the police during 9/11 here in New York City. The House Speaker, Dennis Hastert, castigated John Kerry for flip-flopping on the war. John McCain quoted Franklin Delano Roosevelt, spoke of his Democratic friends, and portrayed the Republicans as multilateralists. But the star of the night was the former New York mayor, Rudolph Giuliani. In the months preceding the convention, the Democrats have accused Republicans of timing and locating their convention to tap into the emotions surrounding the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. While the Republicans have dismissed these accusations, 9/11 was very much the theme of Rudolph Giuliani's speech.
Before September 11, we were living with an unrealistic view of our world, much like observing Europe appease Hitler, or trying to accommodate the Soviet Union through the use of mutually assured destruction. President Bush decided that we could no longer just be on defense against global terrorism. We must also be on offense. On September 20th, 2001, President Bush stood before a joint session of Congress, a still grieving and shocked nation, and a confused world, and he changed the direction of our ship of state. He dedicated America, under his leadership, to destroying global terrorism. The president announced the Bush Doctrine, when he said, "Our war on terror begins with al-Qaeda, but it doesn't end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists." And since September 11th, President Bush has remained rock solid. It doesn't matter to him how he's demonized. It doesn't matter to him what the media does to ridicule him or misinterpret him or defeated him. They ridiculed Winston Churchill. They belittled Ronald Reagan. But like President Bush, they were optimists. Leaders need to be optimists. Their vision is beyond the present, and it's set on a future of real peace and security. Some call it stubbornness. I call it principled leadership. President Bush has the courage of his convictions. In choosing a president, we really don't choose just a Republican or Democrat, a conservative or a liberal. We choose a leader. And in times of war and danger, as we're now in, Americans should put leadership at the core of their decision. There are many qualities that make a great leader, but having strong beliefs,
being able to stick with them through popular and unpopular times is the most important characteristic of a great leader. One of my heroes, Winston Churchill, saw the dangers of Hitler while his opponents characterized him as a warmongering gadfly. Another one of my heroes, Ronald Reagan, saw and described the Soviet Union as the evil empire while world opinion accepted it as inevitable and even belittled Ronald Reagan's intelligence. President Bush sees world terrorism for the evil that it is.
That is former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani speaking in the opening of the Republican National Convention last night in New York at Madison Square Garden. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to Jack Newfield, longtime New York reporter and author of the book The Full Rudy, The Man, The Myth, The Mania. Welcome to Democracy
Pleased
Now.
To be here.
Well, your response to Rudolph Giuliani's address last night.
I felt I was watching a bait and switch operation at a masquerade ball. The Republican Party has moved so far to an extremist right position, they needed Giuliani to make it look moderate and mainstream. And this is made me a little dizzy. It gave me vertigo to see such a distortion of reality, because those of us who lived here under Rudy Giuliani, we saw him trash the First Amendment by refusing, by trying to defund a museum for hanging a picture he didn't approve of. We saw him scapegoat the homeless. We saw him racially divide the city. He is not really a moderate except on social issues like abortion rights, gay rights, immigrant rights, and gun control. He is basically a right winger on most issues, but the Republican Party needed the illusion of his moderation tied to the bogus notion that he was the hero of 9/11 when all he did was do his job. He didn't pull anybody out of the rubble. He didn't climb up the stairs and carry anybody down on his back like a firefighter. He didn't dig for bodies in the wreckage like a lot of construction workers and volunteers did. He just did his job. The day on September 10th, 2001, he had a 40% approval rating. He was being laughed out of town. He was flaunting his adultery with his soon-to-be third wife. And suddenly, because he stood in front of a camera for a week after the atrocity of 9/11, he reinvented himself.
As I left the convention last night after Rudolph Giuliani's speech, I was walking up to Times Square along 8th Avenue, and I passed the Wakamba Lounge. And that was the spot.
I went into that lounge the 2 days after Patrick Dorisman was killed in front of it.
That was March 2000.
Right.
Yes, there is history before 2001, September 11th. Can you explain who Patrick Dorisman was and the role Rudolph Giuliani played in his death?
I think Patrick Dorisman's death by the police and Giuliani's reaction to it was the absolute low of his 8 years of mayor. Patrick Dorisman was an unarmed New Yorker of color. Undercover cops profiled him as maybe someone who was selling drugs. They went up to him and tried to buy drugs from him. He was insulted.
He was a security guard.
He was a security guard who was, you know, hostile to drugs. And there was a fight, and he was killed by plainclothes police officers. And this was just, I think, a few weeks after the police officers who killed Amadou Diallo were acquitted in a trial that was held in Albany because the defense lawyers were able to maneuver it out of the Bronx, where a jury would have been 80 or 85% black and Latino. So they got an ignorant jury in Albany and acquitted him. So I think tensions were high over the acquittal of these four cops who killed Dorisman when this happened. And Giuliani, instead of waiting, you know, a few days to find out what actually happening, what the facts are.
Well, he actually warned New Yorkers not to come to a conclusion right away.
For about 12 hours. And then he himself leaped to a conclusion and illegally released Patrick Dorismond's juvenile arrest record, said he had marijuana in his system by leaking illegally an autopsy report, which is what got me. The next day, Jimmy Breslin and I went to the Wakamba Lounge together just to get a sense of it. And it's a pothead's bar. You can smell pot all over the place. He probably, the marijuana he allegedly had in his system was probably secondhand smoke. Half the people at the bar seemed to be smoking pot, and he had come out of it. And it hit me, this is secondhand marijuana smoke. And there's Giuliani violating his own promise of you know, no rush to judgment and patient analysis of the facts, trashing this dead man who can't defend himself.
Dominic Carter of New York One now challenged the mayor, saying that Patrick Dorismond was no altar boy, because, in fact, Patrick Dorismond was an altar boy.
Yeah, yes.
And interestingly,
and went to Bishop
out,
Lachlan High Schools.
This elite Catholic high school.
That Giuliani himself had gone to. So Giuliani got everything wrong, everything unfair, and is stomped on a dead guy who was killed by his police department for no good reason. He was killed for saying no to drugs.
We're talking to Jack Newfield. He's a longtime New York reporter and has written the book, The Full Rudy, The Man, The Myth, The Mania. As people were streaming out of Madison Square Garden, and I was asking them what for them was the highlight of the night, one after another said, America's mayor. America's mayor. What about New York City and how it fared under Rudolph Giuliani as you continue to talk more specifically about what happened here?
I think you got to remember when the Giuliani ran for mayor in 1989 for the first time as a liberal. He lost to David Dinkins, and then he ran again in 93 as someone who was more conservative, got elected. His first term was okay, and then he became a raving anti-black extremist in his second term, bashing the homeless, cutting services to the poor, racially dividing the city. I felt the racial atmosphere in the city began to get better the minute Giuliani left City Hall.
You wrote a piece a few months ago, Jack Newfield, called Bush to City Drop Dead.
In The Nation magazine.
Your first sentence was, the Bush administration has treated New York City like a battered wife who still gets displayed for photo ops and state dinners. Talk about New York City under President Bush.
Under President Bush, New York City has not gotten its just, fair, necessary level of funding in every area, housing, education, but most, you know, luridly and dramatically in Homeland Security. We are the biggest terrorist target in the world. We were attacked in 1993 and again in 2001. And New York State ranks 49th in the country in Homeland Security funding. The first bit of budget making, there were seven cities, including New York and Washington, that got the money. But then Homeland Security under Bush and Tom Ridge became a pork barrel program like highways. And now there are 80 cities that get a share of the funding. Cheyenne, Wyoming gets more per capita funding than New York City. It's as if the Cheyenne Rodeo is a bigger terrorist target than Yankee Stadium or the subway system or the United Nations. Time and again, many people now have made the point that New York is getting cheated on Homeland Security funding, and nothing changes. Bush and Ridge blame the Congress, which is not right. They are the ones who are underfunding New York and letting places like New Haven and Louisville and Cheyenne get more per capita Homeland Security funding for anti-terrorist preparations than New York City, the number one target in the world, already twice hit. This is so cynical. We've been like battered three times. First, Bush failed to protect us. The FBI and the CIA did not, and the FAA didn't do his job. We were hit. Then he's cheated us out of our rightful share of funding, and now he's using us as a prop for this convention. He's here because of 9/11. Giuliani spoke because he was able to convert himself into America's mayor after 9/11. So it's like a triple bogey against New York City.
Jack Newfield, New Yorkers, do you think the view that people here have of the Bush administration and of Mayor Giuliani is understood in the country? Do you think the media presents a different picture than people here on the ground have?
No, I think nationally and internationally, New York is known as unfriendly to Bush. The world saw more than 500,000 people march here on Sunday. New York City, in polls that I've seen, Bush is getting 27% of the vote in New York City. He's hated here.
The firefighter, Beckwith, the man that...
From Long Island, the retired firefighter.
That President Bush draped his arm around a few days after September 11th.
In a pre-staged
11th.
Photo op.
Well, why don't you explain that? Last night, in looking at the video of President Bush, we saw, you know, his going to ground zero. But explain that.
On September 14th, the president came to ground zero, and I think in a prearranged moment, put his arm around a retired Long Island firefighter. And that became the iconic picture of Bush embracing New York City, even though the guy was not an active duty firefighter, did not live in New York City, and I think was Carro positioned him for that photo op.
Although given the treatment of firefighters afterwards, I understand this firefighter was not very pleased with President Bush.
That I don't know. I haven't seen him really disown or disavow his symbolic role. Although most New York City firefighters and police officers are protesting because the Republican Mayor Bloomberg has refused to give them a contract, has refused to give them a raise. They're very alienated. I marched on Sunday from 14th Street up to 34th, and every time I saw a cop I knew, I said, you guys deserve a raise. This overtime for today is not enough. And they were very angry about not getting their contract and their fair share of a salary.
Oddly, at some moments during various protests over the last few days, as there have been confrontations between protesters and police, and police have cracked down very hard on the protesters, when things got quite tough, sometimes you would hear the protesters chanting, give the cops a raise.
I think that's very shrewd.
Jack Newfield.
And it's true and fair.
I want to thank you for being with us. Jack Newfield is a longtime reporter here in New York. His book is called The Full Rudy, The Man, The Myth, The Mania. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go back to the streets, the suites, and Michael Franti. Stay with us. Bye. from the world. Michael Frantu will be with us in a few minutes. Well, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman as we move from the streets to the corporate suites at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, as well as the Republican Convention here in New York. Prothap Chatterjee of CorpWatch has been filing a series of reports for us about the ties between corporations and the government. Republican Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico is the chair of the Energy and Mineral Resources Subcommittee in the Senate. He wields enormous power over the nuclear power and fossil fuel industry, eager to influence Senator Domenici. Prothap Chatterjee filed this report.
While Midtown Manhattan is snarled up in protests and traffic jams, the oil and gas industry was able to get away from it all at a quiet cafe in Brooklyn, where they threw a party for Senator Peter Domenici of New Mexico.
The River Cafe, once voted among the top five restaurants in New York, boasts a beautiful waterfront view of Manhattan from its perch under the Brooklyn Bridge. We caught up with Jackson Coleman, the legal counsel for the Energy and Mineral Resources Subcommittee that Domenici chairs, and Thomas Moskitis, the director of external affairs for the American Gas Association.
Tell us a little bit about the party that you just attended. Who was it for and why was it held in?
This was in honor of Chairman Pete Domenici, chairman of the Senate Energy Committee. And it was an honor, and for the benefit of also the New Mexico delegation. And it's in his honor, though, for all the work that he's done over the years to take care of the energy needs of America.
Right. We were there to the oil and gas production community. We were there to honor the senator for his work in getting that, or at least trying to get an energy bill through to Congress. We represent all of the customers of natural gas. We represent the companies that distribute natural gas to 60 million consumers nationwide, and we just need more supply to help moderate the prices. And Senator Domenici is doing a great, great effort in that regard. And so we came to a little reception to honor him. And now we're headed off downtown to another one.
Now, you guys are actually spending close to $1 million, I think, on a bunch of receptions at NoChairs. The American Gas Association, I think, is throwing parties all over the city. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's not as much as you think. And what we did was we raised the money from all of our member companies a little bit at a time. It's not like we've got a big campaign chest or anything like that. So we got our member companies to contribute into the pool of money, and then we were able to put on a number, or at least help sponsor a number of the events in New York to honor all the people in Congress who were trying hard to get an energy bill for the country and for the consumers. So that's our aim.
We met a couple of guys who were over there. They were holding up a little sign that said climate stabilization now. And they didn't seem to agree with the party. And I was wondering whether you had a comment. And since you work for the House of Representatives, if they threw a party, would you be going to that party?
Well, I wouldn't be speaking on behalf of the House of Representatives. Any view I would give would be a personal view. But let me just say this. One of the most important things we can do is to continue to take care of the energy needs of the country, no matter where the energy comes from. That's number one. We have to take care of jobs and energy for the people. But we also need to, as much as we can, do it in an environmentally sensitive way. And for instance, natural gas production and provision of energy through natural gas is a very environmentally sensitive way of providing for America's energy.
Not invited to the party was Craig Stair, the founder of Climate Action Now, who staged a two-person protest outside the event.
He simply serves the nuclear industry, rather obviously, without regard to what I call obvious problems connected to it that science has overwhelmingly proven exist. Even in this week's New York Times, they had the editorial, warming to global warming, where the Bush administration was basically being advised to start getting real like the rest of the world. I think Pete Domenici could do a lot more in that direction. I think he's got tons of influence as a politician. He's a very powerful politician, and I think he's doing far less than he ought to if he were really being responsible as representative of the people and the planet he's living on.
For CorpWatch and Democracy Now!, I'm Prothap Chatterjee with Jesse Mann and Ting Ting Cheng.
This is Democracy Now!, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero. Thank you, Prothop, for that report. American Gas Association, yes, is helping to sponsor a big event today at 4 o'clock at Sotheby's over on the east side, the Elite Auction House. I think it's the Tennessee Republicans who will be celebrating Johnny Cash. Some of his memorabilia will be auctioned off. And protesters are calling for a Men in Black block, a protest outside. We had Steve Earle, the musician in our studio on Friday, saying that Johnny Cash would roll over in his grave if he knew he was going to be the person celebrated by at the Republican National Convention. Well, Michael Franti rejoins us, the great hip-hop artist just back from Palestine and Iraq, preparing for a big September 11th Power to the Peaceful rally in San Francisco that has become an annual tradition. Welcome back again, Michael.
Thanks. I hope when I die they have a Democracy Now! Fundraiser auction down at Sotheby's.
What do you think of that today?
I think it's horrible. I mean, Johnny Cash was a rebel, not only just in the musical sense, but he was somebody who was for the people and an advocate for labor, for workers, for prisoners, for people who have been trapped by the criminal justice system.
I wonder if they'll be playing his song, The Mercy Seat, today.
I doubt it.
About the death penalty, something he campaigned against for a very long time. We just got this news in, at least 12 people killed, dozens others wounded today in two explosions within minutes of each other on two buses in the southern city of Beersheba. The blasts occurred around 2:50 p.m. Israel time, close to the city's municipal building. According to paramedics, at least 15 people wounded. The radio report of Israel Radio said Palestinian attackers had carried out an attack. The report couldn't be confirmed. Palestinian militants haven't carried out a suicide bombing inside Israel since March 14th, when 11 people were killed in the port city of Ashdod. Earlier today, Israeli Defense Forces soldiers say they caught a Palestinian man carrying an explosive belt as he tried to cross into Israel from the Gaza Strip. Beersheba is 25 miles west of Gaza City. Michael Franti, you took a trip to Iraq where we talked to you as well as Gaza and West Bank. Your response and your thoughts as you come to the city of the Republican National Convention this week?
Well, the main thing that I've been thinking, just as I've been walking the streets, is my experience of being in Baghdad, where, you know, it's a very large city like New York, but every third or fourth building is blown up. The roar of generators that is constantly requires you to raise your voice even as you're talking to someone very close to you because there's no electricity, so they have to burn generators in front of the buildings. There's no water, and just being out here in the heat of New York, you know, you can go to any grocery store on the corner and get water, and in Iraq you just can't do that. And so just having the experience of being over there and seeing what people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and contrasting it to America's incredible culture shock. And I wish that people who were trumpeting the cause of war at the convention would be able to just see a glimpse of that or experience it for an afternoon.
Would you like to share one of your new songs?
I would. It's a new song I wrote while I was over there. I sang it for soldiers that I met there, and I sang it for Israeli Defense Forces. I sang it for people all over in hospitals who had limbs blown off. And it's called It's Time to Come Home, and it's about, of course, the occupation.
Those who start wars never fight them. Those who fight wars never like them. And those who write laws can recite them. And those who fight laws live and die them. But I know it's time. Yes, I know, oh, it's time. It's time to come home. It's time to come home. It's time to come home. I broke a string. It's time to come home. I see you. Those who build walls are pretending that forever they can defend them. And those who dam streams can build fountains. And I see those of us who just let them be, we can move mountains. But I know it's time. Yes, I know it's time. It's time to come home. 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 And I say, you, you, you,
Michael Franti. Here in our studio, in an old decommissioned firehouse, 100 years old, as he tries to, to sing without that sixth
this
string.
This brings up a great point, which is we met musicians in Iraq who are struggling incredibly just to have basic things. We met a heavy metal band called the Black Scorpions who don't have electricity to run their amplifier. So in a small basement studio, they run a gas-powered generator. So they have to sing over the roar of that generator and deal with the fumes. And during the time when Saddam was in power, they had to write a song singing the praises of Saddam just to be able to make music, even though they hated Saddam. And now that Saddam is out of power, now there's people who want to, you know, attack them for having written this song. And they're just, you know, they're just young kids who want to play heavy metal, and they can't get strings, they can't get heads for their drums, they can't get drumsticks, and it just kind of underscores, you know, the point that people there are really just basic needs are not being met, but also the resilience of people and the endurance of people to make music and to sing songs despite whatever the circumstances are.
So you were in Iraq, and then you went to Israel, to Palestine. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts there as you come back here in one of the closest contested presidential races in a long time that can determine a lot about what happens in the places you were in. Do you feel there will be a difference? Do you think that it matters? How will you be using your music in the next few months?
It has to matter. This the issue of Israel has to be on the agenda, because what we're seeing around the world today, the anger that I felt in not only Iraq, but also in Jordan and in Palestine, and speaking to other people from other Arab nations, is that they see what's happening in Palestine as what could potentially happen to all countries. And that's where the hostility comes from, the Arab nations towards the U.S. And as you see in the convention, people saying over and over again, oh, they're just jealous of us. They're just jealous of Americans. That's why the Arab world hates us. Well, it's not that. It's a direct result of our foreign policy, and specifically, it leads all back to the road leads to Palestine.
Michael, we'll only have a second for your second piece, but people can go to your website and get more information and hear you on September 11th at the Golden Gate Park, the Power to the Peaceful Rally special. Welcome to Austin Community Radio, KAZI 88.7, joining us from Austin, Texas today. We'll be in Asheville, North Carolina, Friday night, Harrisonburg, Virginia, on Saturday. Go to our website, democracynow.org. Special thanks to all the folks who make this show possible, to Mike Burke, Shreef Abdul-Qaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton, Nell Geiser, Jesse Mann, Lee Burek, G. Fresson, Corey Blamire, Sean Stancioff, Sean Clark, Julia Dengel, Rick Rowley, Daniel Cashin, Jenny Filippazzo, Costa Pamianos, and just some of the people helping us as we go out with Michael Franti. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Democracy. democracynow.org.
Standing at the wall in the midday sun, oh, 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 waiting for my time to come. You can say that's the way that the West was won. Staring in the eyes of a man with a gun, in a Palestine or even in a China. Somebody always build a wall to remind you where you're from and tell me your intentions, little baby.